I'm Mike Nowitzki, and this is live from Studio A. Today, we welcome local artist Annie Humphrey, who is originally from Minnesota's Leech Lake Reservation. She had a little bit of a stint away from the area for a while and is now back, kind of. We'll hear about that during this interview. She's got a CD release show tonight at 7 at the American Indian Community Housing Organization with a showing of her art at 6. She's a multifaceted artist, and we're excited to have her in. Annie, thanks a lot for paying us a visit this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, of course. So I'm excited to get into all this stuff and hear about, you know, your sort of career as both a sort of a visual artist as well as a musician, and a little bit about your history. Because have you been here before, live from Studio A?
I don't remember.
Right.
It's been a long time.
I know you you performed last for the Ojibwe Then and Now concert that we did at the Weber Music Hall last March. And I think that may be the most, you know, the closest you've probably been to Studio A. So we're excited to have you here and hear about the new album, Uncombed Hair, which the CD release show is for tonight. And why don't we go ahead and start with the tune just to get an idea of what we're dealing with.
I'm going to start with, this is the first track on the record. And it was inspired by my mother, Anne Dunn. She's an author. And she went to Chiapas in 1996 down in Mexico. And she came back from there. She was a what would you call it, like a objective observer, someone who was just there to observe what was happening between the indigenous people and the Mexican government. And she came home and she said, she goes, you know, I discovered something on this trip. And she said, I discovered that no matter what we do, it'll never be enough. But it's possible to do too little. So I thought that's a really good tune to write about. I mean, that was a really good topic for a song. And it's about a lot of, you know, songs are about a lot of things.
We the people drink oceans of oil. It's not right, we say. As we drive our car to the grocery store just a half a mile away, we cut our way through forest after forest and we scream. Toothpicks tonight. Well, Mama came down from the mountains of Chiapas. She warned, don't let the oppressor stop us. See them
That's Annie Humphrey live from Studio A. I like the bit there about that song seems to come from a sort of a place of frustration. I like the bit about carrying organic food home in plastic bags. That's really interesting.
I do it, you know.
Of course. Crazy. Like, even the people who seem to be the most active in making changes are still sometimes guilty of these destructive practices that we have.
Yeah, so I, you know, this is not finger pointing because I know about diapers because I put my own babies in diapers and I know about styrofoam. And, you know, we all, it's just, but it's so like a natural part of our life. Just we consume oil and we have all this oil based stuff. And then we, you know, we kind of go against the pipeline. I mean, I do, I'm active against the Enbridge pipeline coming through my reservation, but it's like, God, but I'm so dependent as well. So we have either, you know, we got to make some changes in the way we live and consume because we create this demand for oil.
Mm-hmm. And so does that sort of earth stewardship, is that a recurring theme in a lot of your music, would you say?
In the past it has been. You know, this record does that as well, but there are some, there's social stuff and there's some just straight up good love songs on this too. So it's I think in the past I've kind of been tagged as, you know, activist social justice and that's fine, that's awesome, but this record does, I think, cover a lot. It's a wider range of subject.
Sure. Yeah, well, that song was really, it was an interesting perspective on some of those really ingrained problems that society faces, some of that institutionalized stuff that flies under the radar sometimes.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you are originally from Leech Lake, up there, kind of between Grand Rapids and Bemidji, a little closer to Bemidji, mm-hmm. I suppose. You were gone for a while. You joined the Marines back in the, what was it, late 80s, early 90s?
Yep. So I grew up in Cass Lake, and I never really went anywhere. We came from a big family, so when you're a big family with a little money, you really don't hop in the car and go even to a movie theater. So it's kind of sheltered, you know, like in that way. So after high school, I went to college for a little while, and then I got a job, and I was like 23 years old when I enlisted, and that's kind of old going in with a bunch of 18-year-olds, you know?
Yeah.
But I remember sitting at my work one day and I thought, you know, if I don't get out of here soon, I'm just going to get stuck here and never go anywhere.
Yeah. I think most people can relate to that
yeah,
feeling.
I think so too. Yeah. Totally. So that very afternoon, I what are my options? You know, I didn't have a plan or anywhere, but I knew I wanted to go far away.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the recruiter station in Bemidji and I was looking at posters at, you know, which branch would be cool. And I didn't know that women could be Marines, and the recruiter was there, and I went in, and it didn't take long, and I was gone. So I went to Paris Island for basic training, and then my schooling was in purifying water equipment, anything with water. That's what I learned about. And then my first duty station was Japan, and then I came back to Camp Pendleton, and that's where I finished my time. I went to Canada for a while, and I... You know, I swore I'd never come back, but I think everybody always comes back eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I thought that was interesting that you had, you know, chosen the Marines of all branches. Like, growing up in a small town and feeling like you're sort of smothered and, like, joining the military. It's an old story. You know what I mean? Many people mm-hmm. have done this before you, but I was reading about how even now women make up something like 7%. Of the Marines, which is roughly one woman for every 19 men or something mm-hmm. like that. What was that experience like? I mean, did it help at all to be a little bit older than your average peers who were enlisting? Or what was that like being, you know,
I think it did. I think it did help being older. In basic training, let me see. So when I enlisted, I was coaching basketball. So I was running, you know. So when you get in there, there's a lot of physical fitness, you know, a lot of running and rope climbing, and I was just good at doing that. And then there was the rifle range. Now, I'm not a gun person, but for some reason, I was a really good shot, so I graduated on the honor squad because I could shoot so well. Then I got out, and I never probably touched a weapon since, but
yeah.
I think being older, once I got into the fleet, and I was in my platoon with all these men, they weren't really men, they were like 18-year-old boys, and I was older, and you know, they come and ask for advice about women. It's just like anywhere else, really. I mean, it's a different culture, but you know, but the human being is there. And so these guys were just, they're just so young. And I can't believe, you know, I get out now and you read about, you know, casualties and they're just literally, man, they're just boys. You know, if you think about it, fresh out of high school, you think about a boy, you know, who's 18 years old going into this thing. But one thing I'd like to say is I really have a lot of respect for any veteran out there. I love Marines, and I think it's important to thank veterans when you see them. You don't got to make a big deal of it. Just shake their hand. And you can tell who they are. The older guys have the cap with Air Force or Army mm-hmm. or Vietnam or anything. And I always go out of my way to say, hey, you know, thank you, and shake their hand. You don't have to say anything else, you know. But that whole experience for me was really... It's very violent culture, and the indoctrination is pretty intense. But I kind of just stayed me. I'd come home on leave, and I'd kind of behave the same way. And my little brother, who was also in the Marine Corps at the same time, in fact, we were stationed on Okinawa together, he would be sitting all rigid and not smile and be very serious, and I was still me, you know.
Yeah, some people are able to keep that sort of separate in their mind. Yeah, yeah. Not everyone has that, but...
In fact, we were in the field in Japan one time, and everybody had the cami paint, and we were all tactical looking, and we had to put weeds and stuff from the grass in our Kevlar helmet to camouflage ourselves. Well, I put flowers in my Kevlar. I picked purple flowers and all these little flowers. And
what did they think of that?
Oh, they knew me by then. And for tactical paint, sometimes I do like a really cool little raccoon face, and you're supposed to just smear it camouflage, right? They go, Humphrey, what the heck are you doing? You know, and so after a while, so I put my little flowers in my Kevlar, and but they knew me. I had respect because I could run as far as the men, and I could hump mountains with the guys without falling out. And so they accepted it from me being that way. And so that day I had the flowers in my helmet, and we had to sit down and take a rest. And so the guys were sitting with their M16s between their knees, pointing up away from them toward the sky. And I remember walking by, and I take a little flower from my helmet, and I drop it in their barrel, and I say, make love, not war. And they're like, get out of here. But you know, after I looked behind me and we started marching, I'd see all those little flowers. I mean, that's a visual I'll never forget, my little flowers in the barrels of the M16s. I guess, you know, I mean, I was hardcore, but I was also this other thing, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, I'd like to have a picture of that one. And you went to the police academy after that.
Yep, I did. Well, I was at the end of my tour in the Marine Corps, and I thought, I don't know, it's like civilian life was kind of scary. And once you're in this thing, it's hard to think, oh my God, I'm going to be a civilian. Ew. But so I thought having a job that had a uniform, weapon, formation, and all that stuff,
yeah.
Right? But once I was halfway through the academy, I knew I didn't want to be a cop. But I mean, I finished and graduated, but I never went into that field mm-hmm. of work.
So immediately after that, you decide, okay, I guess this is sort of a misdirection. I don't really want to be a police officer.
Yeah.
Was it immediately after that that you kind of went back to, you know, making art, both music and...
Nope. You know what? After I got out of the Marine Corps, I got back home. I had my first child. And I started thinking, I think, and people ask, you know, how come you went from, you know, the Marine Corps to singing nonviolent and folksy stuff? And I think, and it's because I had a kid, and become a mother, I think everything changes. Or you become a father, your attitudes about a lot of stuff change, I think. So I got out and I started getting active in a lot of like grassroots, you know, stuff, and just going to meetings and going to rallies and doing this and that. And I didn't know how effective I was being, you know. So I was at an event I performed at, and my by then I had two kids, and they were both barely walking, and they're less than 2 years apart. And I saw a man walking around this event, and he had a black hat and an eagle feather. I thought, I bet he can tell me what to do. And so I went as an elder, and I gave him tobacco. I said, I just need to ask you something. I said, what should I do with my life? And now that I think about it, that's a huge question to ask a stranger, you know. But he just looked at my kids, and he looked at me, and he said, well, just keep on singing and be a good mother. And that's the best advice I ever got. And the only advice I've really followed in everything has just worked out.
So civilian life turned out to be not,
Awesome.
No. It's working out good. You can live in both worlds.
Yeah.
Good. Can we hear another song?
Sure. I'm going to, I'm going to do a song inspired by my son I just mentioned. His name is Justice, and he's all grown up now. And he always, we lived in Cass Lake, and he'd always say stuff like, "Mom, I'm never going to leave you because I got to take care of you." And he had a little sister, too, and has a little sister. And he said, "I can't leave you girls alone. I'm going to stay and take care of you." So, but and I hear that a lot, people saying, you know, you can leave the reservation and go to college, but come back and help your people. And I just think that's the most unfair statement to make to a young person. You know, make them think, you can go, but you got to come back here. And, you know, I'm trying to leave here. And eventually we all come back anyway. So, I think. I did. And I know a lot of people who have. Line, but you've got mountains to find and climb. Your dreams, they won't be found, just laying on this never changing ground. Gotta find a road to walk out on. Admit, but I'd rather see you fly than sit. So go now, don't worry about me. If you stay too long, you'll sink in the muck, and on this reservation you'll get stuck. Gotta find a road to walk out on. Mountains to find and climb. Your dreams, they won't be found, just laying on this reservation ground. Gotta find a road to walk out on.
It's Annie Humphrey live from Studio A. Nice enough to pay us a visit this morning. Got a new album coming out. Is it out? Is it out yet? This is just a CD release show for Duluth tonight.
It's out.
It's out.
I mean, it's barely out.
It's barely out. It's a brand spanking new project that we got working on.
So last time I was here at Symphony Hall, the Weber
Music Hall, just down the hall here.
Yeah, it wasn't even done.
Okay.
So it's pretty new.
It was still in the works. All right. Yeah. Well, so you know, you were talking about how when you first got started, it was kind of playing around in coffee shops and sort of around the region and things like that. But my understanding is it grew from there a little bit. I know I saw some awards that you won back at, you know, maybe 14, 15 years ago at the Native American Music Awards out in New York. Some past winners and Hall of Famers from this particular awards ceremony: Robbie Robertson of the band, Bill Miller, Nelly Furtado, John Trudell, another Minnesota guy, Keith Cicola, even Hank Williams, Jimi Hendrix. These guys are in there. That's kind of a big deal. That was, you know, a few years ago. But where did the career go once it started to kind of gain some headway?
Well, let me back up to where I started playing music. I was in bands in the Marine Corps. Even I was always in bands, and I played bars before. And you know, when I had kids, you know, you can't drag your kids to a bar, you know. So I did do the coffee house. And we were on welfare. We were getting food stamps and money, you know, monthly. But the sanctions were coming down when my kids were little, and that means you had to start weaning yourself off of the welfare system. And so that, for me, that was like, what's going to happen? You know, I'm not going to have this help anymore. And I know people kind of knock women on welfare, and really, you should not, because I was living on $321 a month. No, I'm not living high on the hog with two kids and $321. And in fact, during that time, I did a musical piece for a girl doing her master's thesis, and one of the slides had two dogs on the White House lawn. They were Nixon's dogs. And she said the living allowance of these two dogs was more than a family of four in that time. I mean, so, you know, people just don't sweat welfare, you know. And if women buy something, like, I don't know. I've heard it all, because I was, you know, on welfare with my children. And it's so unfair. Everybody's doing their best, man. Just let everybody do their best. So the career, I got really busy, and these awards really helped. That was 15 years ago. You know, it's a long time ago. And I was traveling a lot. In fact, one year, I was on the road like 175 days a year, and I would take my two kids whenever I could. I mean, if I had a drive to New Mexico, I would go over the road just to take them with me. And they lived like that for a while. And we relocated to Wisconsin, and we had neighbors their age. And my son said, where do Justin and Holly go every day? I said, well, they go to school. And he's like, a couple days later, he said, Mom, I want to go to school, because they were homeschooling. I want to go to school and have friends my own age. And I thought, well, you do have friends, Justice. You have a lot of friends. He goes, I don't have friends my own age. So sure enough, you know, shortly after that, we had to go to Detroit. And I looked at my kids, and they were interacting with all these adults and in the audience and people. And he was right. And so, you know, I thought it would be fair to let them go to school. So once I got them in school, I'd say no. You know, I'd say, no, I can't go and do this, or I can't go do that. And then things just kind of slow down after a time. And so they slowed down so much, I had to get a job. So then I got a job, and then I got another job, and I was working full time. Then I went to college and finished my degree. And by then I was like taking care of kids, going to school, working, and I hardly ever got a call to play music. So it just happened, evolved into that, you know, and it was fine. I love my life. I love my kids, and I'm glad I finished school. And yeah, but my whole life did evolve into just going to work and taking care of animals and kids. And then I met my husband, Todd, a couple of years ago, and he asked me, why aren't you playing music and writing songs? And I said, well, my excuse before was because my kids were little and they want to stay home and go to school, so I came off the road. Well, now they're 21 and 19, and the excuse is gone. And I thought about it. I thought, I don't know why not. So I started writing, and it just all came pouring out, and I got a record now 15 years later, and we'll just see what happens.
Just like riding a bike.
Yeah.
So tonight obviously is a concert. It's a CD release show and a concert, but there's another aspect of this show as well. So music is something that you kind of picked up and sort of learned organically, the way that a lot of people do. But visual art is something you actually studied formally for a while.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yep. I went to school for get my bachelor's in the fine arts. Okay. And I'm a painter, and you can't see me, but I'm full of paint on my cool bibs here. But I just love all sorts of art. I do a lot of beadwork and traditional stuff, and I recycle furniture and paint it up. And my last show I sold a bunch of furniture, and I get sick of things really quick. So I'll go really hard and do something, then I'll just drop it and start something new. So between my last show and this show, I switched out art forms, and I started sewing jingle dresses. And a jingle dress is a healing dress, and I think that the world is in a lot of trouble, the earth and its people and its governments and its systems, and everything is in a lot of trouble. And we are all on the same boat, and we're all going to sink together. And so these jingle dresses to me are kind of a cry for help. You know, we need more healing, and I believe that prayer is a real powerful thing. You know, when Princess Di and Mother Teresa died on the same weekend, the world, the spin of the world was smoother. I mean, physically, the earth rotated smoother, and then it started wobbling again. But I thought, that must be the power of all these people, you know, praying. And so, you know, if our prayer can affect the spin of the world, I think, you know, this prayer healing dress can help our people. And so I'm hoping that people will come and not look at, like, oh, Annie's trying to make money on these dresses, but I really want to get them out and on little girls, and I want to go dance with them next summer, and I want to see them out there, and I just want to dance with them. So, you know, if you got a little old lady girl who needs a dress, please come and we'll work out a deal.
So that's part of the show tonight as well at the American Indian Community Housing Organization. It's an art show and a concert and sort of a little bit of everything. Can we, here, I better do a station identification. It's 103.3 KUMD Duluth Public Radio. This is live from Studio A with Annie Humphrey. We got time for one more tune. Can we hear another one?
All right. My mom is a poet, and so this is actually one of her poems that I took. Well, I didn't take. I asked her. So, it's a mysterious love song, and she's never told me who it's about, and I've never asked her. But she really, really likes Elvis, so it might be about Elvis.
I've always been too late for love. There could have been a time for us. We never took a chance. Fear of rejection, or good common sense. I liked you. Could have loved your honest face, your quiet grace. Tender style. you with my eyes. I liked you very much, though we never touched. I could love your honest face and your quiet grace and your simple smile and your tender style. My
fade out.
That's Annie Humphrey live from Studio A. She has a new album called Uncombed Hair, which she's playing a CD release show for this evening at the American Indian Community Housing Organization, which is 202 West 2nd Street here in Duluth. It's also, there will be a showing of her art as well. So it's kind of a two-part show and should be a good time. Annie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Anytime. To check out upcoming guests or listen to previous sessions, go to KUMD.org. Today's Live from Studio A session was produced by Christine Dean, web assistant Aaron Welch, and myself, Mike Nowitzki. Check out Live from Studio A under programs at KUMD.org. This is Live from Studio A on 103.3 KUMD. Thanks for listening.